just very quick overview of the facts. With 50 months left on the lease, the McAllisters notified Half-Breeze that they are going to leave the property due to what they perceived as a breach of the lease on the part of the landlords, Half-Breeze Properties. They subsequently left. They heard nothing from Half-Breeze for several months. Then they received a demand letter from the plaintiff's attorney informing them that they needed to pay within 10 days or else suit would be filed. The matter was heard in the 141st District Court, and according to the judgment, the court disposed of all of the counterclaims, defenses, and affirmative defenses at the summary judgment hearing. There was no order from the summary judgment hearing the first time. We got that information was actually in the judgment where he spelled out what he ruled on. The case then continued to a bench trial to allow Half-Breeze to prove up its damages. After the summary judgment, but before the trial, the property was released, and Half-Breeze filed an amended petition where they reduced their amount of damages to take into account that releasing, but then they also added additional alleged breaches of the contract, things like failure to mow the lawn, failure to fix the HVAC system. In the time period after the McAllisters left the property and before the property was relet, the McAllisters responded by filing an amended answer in which we raised the issue of notice, saying that the contract required notice and opportunity to cure those alleged new deficiencies, those alleged new breaches of the contract, and that notice was never given. At trial, the court basically gave Half-Breeze Properties everything they were asking for. Now, as the court is undoubtedly aware, there are a whole lot of issues on this appeal, and I'm clearly not going to get to them all. I wanted to focus today on what I think is one of the more interesting issues and one of the more contentious issues, and that is whether the damages provision of the contract is enforceable, and we contend it's not, and then from that, what should the correct measure of damages be? From timing myself, I'm not sure I'm going to have much time left afterwards, but afterwards I'd like to proceed to some other issues or open it up for the court to tell me if there's any issues they would specifically like me to address. Now, this contract contained in Section 11.02 a section called remedies, which spelled out approximately eight different remedies that the landlord was able to use in the event of a breach. The plaintiff has asked that we just leave it at that and enforce the contract on its face, citing to the general rule that parties have freedom to contract. That issue, as mentioned in my brief, has been specifically addressed by the Texas Supreme Court in the case Stewart v. Basie. And in that case, the court stated that the rights of competent parties to make their own bargains is not unlimited, that the universal rule for measuring damages for a breach of contract is just compensation for the loss actually sustained. And by operation of that rule, the party should be awarded neither more than or less than their actual damages, and that a party has no right to have a court enforce a stipulation which violates that underlying principle. And that's exactly what this issue is about, that damages provision. In fact, the case of Stewart v. Basie is on point in this case. Stewart v. Basie was a breach of commercial lease case. In that case, the contract provided for several covenants, and then the damages provision said for a breach of any of those covenants, we get to get the same damages. It was $150 a month, I believe, times however many months were remaining on the lease. Now, in the matter before the court today, we have basically the same facts. The lease states in Section 11.01b, the lease states that for a breach of any other covenant in the lease, that it's declared a default. And then if we look at 11.02, it says for any default, you get any or all of these following damages. The language couldn't be better tailored to run afoul of Stewart v. Basie. And the ruling in Stewart v. Basie was, in that situation, the damages provision is void, and we have to go to the common law. Now, we also, in our brief, went on to attack the question of whether the damages provision is enforceable under using the traditional standard of a liquidated damages provision. And we cite to that, it's argued in the brief And like I said, I don't have enough time to get through everything, so I'm gonna leave that to the brief. In defense of this issue, the Hatbreeze Properties in their brief cites to a few issues. First off, they do not address this Stewart v. Basie argument. They move on to just address the second one. I can't find a way to distinguish that case, but I'm sure counsel will instruct us. The OP's response, she stated that she is seeking to recover under section 11.02B of the contract, and so that she should be allowed to do that because it's substantially the same as the common law. Now, first off, I'd like to point out under Stewart v. Basie, the damages provision would be void, and so it doesn't matter which one she's arguing under, it's gone. So that means we get kicked out to the common law. But even if we were to indulge that, I would secondly like to point out that this suit under 11.02B is relatively recent. There's no question that she initially sought to recover under the acceleration clause of the contract. That was her initial demand letter. That was the initial lawsuit. That was the lawsuit through the granting of the summary judgment. And the reason that becomes important is that the courts have instructed us that when trying to figure out what measure of damages has been invoked, it is an election of remedies, and that we look at what they actually did, what demand letter they sent. And that becomes important sort of for the next issue, which we're going to discuss, what is the correct measure of damages in this case. I would also like to point out that she states that 11.02 is substantially the same as the common law. That's untrue. Otherwise, I wouldn't be up here arguing about it. If the damages she had been given were the same as the damages she was entitled to under the common law, and I'll get to this in the next section, then I certainly wouldn't have wasted this court's time by coming up here and arguing that issue. And as a final point on this 11.02B argument, I'd like to point out that if this was under 11.02B, the court did not properly award damages under 11.02B. 11.02B, the language states that they can re-rent the property and from either month to month or from time to time send a demand letter asking for the deficiency. That provision of the contract looks backwards. What happened in this case was the court awarded the full measure of damages throughout the entire term of the contract. At the time of the judgment, I think there were still 20 months left on the lease, which should not have been awarded under 11.02B if that was in fact what the court was trying to do. The next issue that she brings up, she mentions briefly in a sentence that this might be a limitation of liability provision and therefore enforceable. It's not a limitation of liability provision. It doesn't purport to limit liability. It in no way limits liability. It's titled remedies, not limit of liability. So I don't believe that argument has merit. Assuming that the provision is void, the next question we have to ask is, what is the correct measure of damages? What should the court have awarded? And this was set under the Austin Hill case. Austin Hill was a very important case in the world of commercial leases. I'm not sure if the court's familiar with it or not, but it was basically a case where the court said before 1996, when this case was decided, Texas followed the English common law, which was that leases are not subject to contract law, basically. And so there was no mitigation of damages. There were no contract remedies, and it created this duality where there were suits under contract, and then if you didn't plead your contract right, there were suits under common law if you messed up, which generally gave you worse damages. The Austin Hill case seems to indicate that's gone, but they also went on and explained what four measures of damages are available in a breach of commercial lease case. You can maintain the lease and sue for rent as it becomes due. You can treat the breach as anticipatory repudiation. You can repossess the property and sue for the present value of future rentals reduced by the reasonable value of the property for the remainder of the lease term. So basically, what the lease said you get minus what the value of the property for that month was. You can treat the breach as anticipatory, repossess, release the property, and sue the tenant for the difference between what you got under the old contract and what you got under the new contract. Or you can declare the lease forfeit and relieve the tenant of liability. Now, there's, as I stated earlier, when choosing this, we're supposed to look at what the landlord actually did, what they actually elected. The case law is clear. When someone sues for rent that has not yet become due, they are treating the breach as an anticipatory repudiation, and they are locked into either number two or three in their damages. Where that becomes important is more than one clever attorney who messed up that issue has on appeal argued, well, no, I was actually maintaining the lease and suing for rent as it became due, because at the time it got to trial or at the time it got on appeal, all the lease, you know, all the rent had become due. And so they wanted to get their full measure of damages, and the courts have universally said, no, you sued for rent that wasn't due, this was an anticipatory repudiation, therefore you're locked in, and you can only get under two or three. This case does present a not unique twist, but an interesting twist, which is that we had a time period when the property was not relet, and then a time period when the property was relet. And so that gave me a few sleepless nights as I tried to figure out, does that mean that under measure three, they release the property, and then they get 100% of the lease for the first time period and then the reduced amount for the second time period? And the courts have come down again on that. No, this case is cited in my briefs. It's Matilda v. Main Building of Houston. In that case, the court said that when you have this mixed situation for the time period when it's not leased, you take the amount that would have been gotten under the lease and you reduce it by the fair market value of the rent. And then for the time period it was leased, you take the amount that they should have gotten under the old lease and reduce it by the new lease. So, and I would also like to cite the court to, there's a newer case that says the same thing. It just sort of puts a nice bow on it. It's GKG Net v. Mitchell Rubber Properties. It's at 330 Southwest 3rd, 426 out of the Houston 14th. That case was decided December 23rd, 2010. I hadn't found it at the time I briefed it. But it doesn't really bring up anything new. It agrees that the proper measure of damages in this case is that mixed measure of damages. It also goes on to point out that once it goes to trial, the burden is actually on the landlord to prove what the value of the property was for, you know, what the actual value property was that you reduce the lease amount by. No, Your Honor, there is not.
So, in your brief, at one point, you asked that the case be reversed and that this court order the damages that are proper under the law and the facts of this case. Mm-hmm. What is your measure of damages? What are you asking the court to do?
Well, quite frankly, Your Honor, what I'd like the court to do is find that they failed to meet the burden of proof by failing to introduce that damage, that, and they're not allowed to recover. I did solicit from the landlord, one of the representatives, I did get him to say on the stand that he thought the property was worth $3,500 a month. And so, you know, if we wanted to reduce it, we could. My concern is that, according to the court, this is an affirmative defense, and they resolved all the affirmative defenses on summary judgment. And although they don't specifically mention this one, we might be in a situation where since the issue was decided on summary judgment, they didn't have their full burden to introduce the evidence at trial and were sort of locked into sending it back to trial court to give them a chance to introduce that evidence. You follow what I'm saying?
I follow what you're saying, yes.
Yeah, and I do apologize for that. I understand it's an awkward situation, but we just got locked in on that.
So you're saying since you got this representative to testify that it was worth $3,500 a month and you were supposed to be paying $3,500 a month with the proper measure of damages,
Yes, Your Honor, that's what the case law says. If there's no further questions, I see my time is up. Thank you, Your Honors.
Counsel? May it please the court. Kelly Decker for appellees, plaintiffs in the underlying suit. Counsel? without going into facts, I'll just jump on that same issue that he was just discussing. That portion of the law only applies if it's shown that the landlord retakes the property for their own use. You'll see in the findings of fact and conclusions of law, the trial court found that we had not retaken the property and that we had not terminated the lease. Also, there was no objection to that finding of fact. In fact, there's no objection or request for an additional finding as to the argument of the acceleration penalty and common law, kind of this argument that he's making that we need to use the common law measure of damages. So I would argue that he's waived it, and he can't even bring that up today. And you don't typically, obviously, but the findings of fact as to damages we actually have. We don't have a statement from the court on what grounds they granted the summary judgment motions, but they were both granted. So his burden would be to negate all of the grounds that it could have been found.
Let me ask you while I'm thinking of it. In their brief, they respond to your argument that they're only attacking the no evidence motion for summary judgment. His response is that in your traditional motion for summary judgment, that you did not move on the counterclaim for breach of contract or the issues related to fraudulent inducement. Is that correct?
No, that's not correct. It's in the original motion for traditional and no evidence summary judgment, and it's also reiterated in the supplemental motion. The reason why there's a supplemental motion is because two amended answers were filed in between the first summary judgment motion and the second summary, the supplemental. So I supplemented that to add the new defenses that he's alleged. At first he had the fraud claims couched as a defense, and then he had them couched as a counterclaim as well as a defense. So I amended, included some additional evidence, and so all of the defenses were before the court on the traditional and no evidence summary judgment motion. They were both granted. I didn't see anywhere in his brief ever a mention of a traditional summary judgment. I would argue that since it wasn't raised, that it's waived and that the traditional summary judgment stands on its own. My summary judgment included negating grounds of their defenses, so I feel that even if you were to review it today, it would stand on its own. And also, he made an argument that the traditional is fairly included in his analysis of the no evidence. And I would just argue, I haven't found a case anywhere that says you can fairly include another ground for relief in where there's another standard of review. So I would argue that it's not fairly included. Just going back to the facts of this case, it's a commercial lease agreement of a 15,000 square foot warehouse. It is everything you can imagine about a big space that's on the east side of Fort Worth that went for, the rent was a progressive rent, started out at $1,500 a month and went to $3,500. This space was used by McAllister for cabinet manufacturing, and in, it was March of 2009, a bad time of our history, they vacated, and they cited the reason that they, in their mind, they thought that the landlord had terminated their insurance, which only benefited the landlord. And because of that belief that the landlord had terminated insurance, they vacated. There was no notice, no opportunity to fix it. Later, when we filed suit, they came back and said, and actually, something that might be really helpful is if you just see their affidavit. They have two affidavits from the summary judgment hearing. That's all that they have in support of the response to summary judgment. In there, they cite, okay, first we go into the property, we see that there's a shed, there's a metal shed. It doesn't look like it's in that great of a condition, but the space, despite its problems, we decided to go ahead and lease it. Then after we filed suit, there was a chemical sludge, and then there was a leaky roof, and all of these things that didn't have any, there was no evidence presented at all to substantiate any of those claims. Because this affidavit is important in more than one way. It is their only evidence in response to summary judgment, but also it's their only evidence that was used at trial. It wasn't actually entered at trial, but the tenants, the McAllisters, did not call any witnesses. They asked one or two questions of the landlord, and that was it. And we had one of those rocket trials in front of Judge Chupp over a lunch hour, and it was great. We got all our damages done, and that's what happened. Going back to the no evidence summary judgment motion, to respond to that, the McAllisters claim, one, that the no evidence summary judgment shouldn't have been granted as to their counterclaim for breach of contract, which goes back to the insurance question. There is no evidence that the insurance was ever canceled. In fact, there's evidence by affidavit that the insurance was in place during this entire time. Secondly, even if it wasn't in place, it's not a material breach because the McAllisters didn't stand to have any benefit from the landlord insuring the landlord, which is what the contract required. Thirdly, the McAllisters showed no evidence of damages. They have one paragraph in their affidavit that talks about $106,000 in relocation costs, but that's it. And that's, we objected to it being conclusory, and we're also raising that on the first time on appeal because we did not get a ruling. The other counterclaim they had was fraud, common law fraud, and fraud in the inducement. There is no evidence presented that the roof was not new, which is one of the bases of their claim. Landlord advertised that the roof was new. It turns out it leaked. Since the ceiling leaked, then it must not have been new. That's all the evidence that they have. They don't have any roofer testimony. All they have is ceiling leakage, which was related to an AC leak. Also, there is no causation because in their affidavit, he states, had they informed me that the insurance was still on the property, I would have continued to work with them to remedy the other defects on the property rather than vacating. So by his own testimony, he's saying it wasn't that big of a deal that the roof was leaking or that the ceiling was leaking. There's no causation there. There's also no causation because there was a valid disclaimer of reliance. It was a really good disclaimer. It wasn't one that was found in the Cowboy case. It fully briefed, I've inspected the property, I'm not relying on any representations except for my own review of the property. And then the damages at trial. Again, there were no objections or offers of additional findings of fact and conclusions of law. There's ample evidence to support damages for the unpaid rent, which was proved up by, and going to damages, as far as it being a penalty, there is no other way to prove up our damages other than the rent that wasn't paid, which was about 20 months, less than that, and then 20 months left that we found a new tenant, which the difference was $100 a month, proved up those two items, and then new damages, which were we had to pay a realtor about $8,200 to release the property to find this new tenant. We had to do a couple of minor improvements, including removing some of the items that the tenant installed. And so those were out-of-pocket expenses.
What is your response to his argument that you gave him no notice of those? I know you said in your brief you're not required to give him notice, but in reading the contract, it appears to me you were required to give him notice, and I don't think a motion for summary judgment is notice. I didn't see any case law today.
Well, Your Honor, again, as I said in my brief, we weren't required to give him notice. Secondly, those items came up. I mean, we reduced.
What about section, I think it's 11.01B, which specifically says you're required to give him notice? I mean, what am I reading wrong there? That's not what it says.
If you'll just give me a second here.
It says, failure of tenant to comply with any term, condition, or covenant of this lease other than payment of rent or other sum of money and the continuance of that failure for a period of 30 days after landlord delivers written notice of the failure to the tenant. Doesn't that require notice?
I'm sorry, I heard what you said, but I'd like to be able to find it.
Sure, it's 1101B, default and remedy.
Your Honor, this provision is under the default section. We're and as opposed to our section, what we're relying on is not requiring to give any notice, I believe, is under the remedies. We're not saying they're in breach of the lease because they didn't reimburse us for electricity costs or cost to relet. We're talking about... We're talking about remedies here, and we're not citing a new ground for a breach of contract.
Okay, so you're going under 1102B. Would that be correct?
Yes, but then also. Yes, that's right. Any deficiency that may arise, I apologize, I've got it written more than one place. But yeah, 11.02B remedies, that's where we're arguing new damages. And again, that was all, you know, under the term to pay rent, not because they're in breach of the lease because they didn't pay their utility bills. The measure of damages, obviously, it's a question of law. Common law does not apply where there's a lease. If you see the Speedy Mart case, it specifically says, here are the damages, the four items outlined by McAllister's, except for when there's a lease, except for when there's terms regarding remedies. As far as the statement that just compensation, no more, no less, with respect to damages and them being punitive, or this argument of a liquidated damages issue. We sued for the rent that hadn't been paid. We sued for the difference and after we mitigated our damages, and we sued for our out-of-pocket costs. Anything less would be unjust compensation. Anything more would be we didn't ask for. Yeah, we did originally ask for an acceleration, but that was before we got a new tenant. So we, you know, it'd be one thing if we continued to seek the total amount of the 5-year lease, but we didn't. We sought just what we were out. And again, the anticipatory breach, when you look at the common law damages, that only applies if the lease has been terminated by the landlord and we've retaken possession. Since there's no objection to the finding of fact or conclusion of law and there's no offer of additional ones, and there's evidence to support that we did not terminate the lease. You'll see the testimony that the landlord said we were always releasing it, we were always showing it. Obviously, they did a very good job because they were able to find a new tenant. With that, unless there's any more questions, I'll stand on my brief.
Mr. Tucker, I'd like to ask you, there seems to be these two cases that the appellant has focused on in this briefing. And one is the Stewart against Basic case, and the other one is the Austin case talking about the various remedies.
Mm-hmm. Those cases have to do with a situation where the landlord has terminated the lease and retaken possession. If you see the Stewart case,
it's
quoted in his brief even, the violation of any term of this lease by either party hereto shall terminate at the same option of the other. It goes on to say the lease contains several covenants in other than the covenant to pay rent. And that was what was incorrect about applying the remedies in that lease was because they were broad about, you know, for every violation of the lease. You don't pay your utility bills, you still have to pay the same damages if you don't pay rent. In our case, we sued for unpaid rent.
All right, thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Rebuttal?
Yes. Very briefly, Your Honor, I'd like to rebut, first off, this position. She said that the question under the common law is, did they terminate the lease and retake the property? It's not. In fact, if you look at the Austin Hill case, terminating the lease is measure of damages number 4, where you terminate the lease and relieve them of any duty. No one's alleging that they're allowed to, or that they've moved for measure number 4. It also, the common law is clear. The question is not, did they terminate it? It's, did they treat it as an anticipatory breach? The question is, did they keep the lease in effect, or did they treat it as an anticipatory breach? And the case law says it's an anticipatory breach if they sue for rent that has not yet become due. If they're acting like, now the other fact she brought up, the fact that they reoccupied the property, and we did challenge this finding of fact, the fact that they reoccupied the property, the fact that they stored personal items on the property, the fact that they allowed third parties to use the property and store items on the property, those aren't necessary. I just think it makes it a little bit more palatable to say that, yes, they actually reoccupied the property. And so it makes it a little less difficult to say their demand letter denies them the money. But it's certainly not necessary under the common law, and there's cases that specifically deal with them, and some of them are cited in my brief.
Mr. Wallace?
Yes, Your Honor.
Look at page 3 of your brief, your appellate's brief. There you're citing the various provisions for a proper measure of damages under the Austin Hill case. And one of those is number 3, the treat the breach as a anticipatory. That's your contention of what they did, isn't it?
Number 2 and 3 are both treat the breach as anticipatory,
right,
Your Honor. Mm-hmm.
And did they repossess the property?
Yes, Your Honor.
And then did they release the property to a new tenant?
Yes, Your Honor.
And then did they sue for the difference between the contractual rent and the amount received from the new tenant as an item of damages?
That was one item of damages, Your Honor, but I think I know what you're getting at, and I'd like to point out we specifically deal with that. It's the Matilda case and the new case we cited to you, the GKG case. When we have a situation, this is not the first time this situation's come up where there's mixed between the two.
Right.
And in that situation, you apply 2 to the portion where it's unoccupied and 3 to the portion where it is occupied.
And isn't that what the trial court did, finding the damages here?
No, Your Honor, because the trial court allowed them to accelerate the entire, or to seek the entire amount due for the unoccupied portion and did not properly reduce that by the fair market value of the property during that time period. Under the common law, it's treated from the point they actually make the demand letter. So when I use the term accelerated, that's because their initial demand letter accelerated all amount due, and under the common law it said that's the time we look at. We look at what they actually do when they initiate the suit. Now, at the time we got to trial, they had gotten through, obviously, the remainder of that period, and I think it was the first month of their lease to the new person. So it wasn't accelerated at that point, because enough time had passed, but under the common law, they had already made their election. They were already locked into measure of damages 2 and 3, instead of being able to seek under measure of damages 1, which is where they probably wanted to be.
What is your response to their argument that your brief is only attaching the no evidence motion for summary judgment? And do you have any? Because I looked very carefully at it. I don't see where you attack the traditional motion for summary judgment. And do you have any case law authority for a position that it's fairly assumed that you're attacking those?
No, Your Honor. First off, I would cite the court to their actual briefs. I think that the briefs are clear. She only addresses the breach of contract issue in her traditional motion for summary judgment, the first one. Her no evidence motion for summary judgment never raises the issue, and then her supplemental motion for summary judgment never raises the issue. And that's, you know, I went through when I prepared this and went line by line down her, and I may be wrong, I just asked the court to look at what she actually said, because according to what I read, she didn't challenge it. That's why we've gone back and forth on this issue. No, Your Honor, it does on the issues of breach of contract. I'm pretty sure.
Okay.
Yes, Your Honor. Did the trial court commit error in granting appellant's motion for summary judgment on parent's claim of discharge? We also have did the trial court error in finding that the terms of the contract? I'm not finding it right now, Your Honor, but I believe that on the contract issues, it specifically, because when I wrote it out, it specifically went back and forth. The contract issues, it challenged them. Our counterclaim for breach of contract. Well, okay, it gets complicated because there's two breach of contracts here, but it does, some issues are challenged on traditional, some issues are challenged on no evidence, some are challenged, I believe, on both, and it just, each issue states how it was.
Okay.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank both counsels. We appreciate your arguments. Complicated case, and the briefs and arguments are both very good. Your case is submitted, and we will excuse you, and we're going to adjourn until 10:30 when we will hear the third case of Murphy and Tornberg versus Gutierrez. So we stand adjourned.
All rise.